From New Mexico to South Carolina, Alaska to Louisiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Biden administration rule changes are set to make federal procurement and construction projects more costly to taxpayers. Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to explain. Inflation ticked up more in June than it did in July as the Fed fight to bring inflation under control continues. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Government regulation is the reason why we can't have nice things. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine looks at the recent baby formula shortage as he debuts a new podcast series. And Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College recalls his interview with Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb, on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Biden administration is implementing a rule change that affects how it calculates the prevailing wage. That's the wage that must be paid on federal contracts. The cost to taxpayers will be significant. To learn more, we turn to Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, welcome to American Radio Journal. Sean, before we talk about the latest regulatory changes being brought about by the Biden administration, tell us a little bit about the National Labor Relations Board, and specifically, what is the Davis-Bacon Act, and what does it govern?
The Davis-Bacon Act is the law related to federal contracting, and it's a law that says in all contracts, the contractor must pay the workers the prevailing wage for that work in the area. In other words, it's to ensure that the workers are getting paid a good scale wage. In practice, what this means is they're getting paid about what union work in the same area would be paid. The prevailing wage is set by the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. They basically just do a survey of local businesses doing this work, and they put that out there. And if you want to be on a federal contract, you have to pay the wage that the Wage and Hour Division says is the prevailing one for that region for that type of work.
And how has this worked out over the years? Davis-Bacon Act has been around for quite a long period of time. What has been its impact on the cost of federal projects?
Basically, it just drives the cost up. I mean, it forces the wages up higher than it would be. It essentially means that there's not much point in trying to underbid the contract by tightening up on labor costs. There's just not much point to it because you're going to have to pay basically the relatively same wage. You have to pay the same wage no matter what. So there's no point in trying to underbid the contract in that way, and that costs taxpayers more. Essentially, the real world purpose of it is to make it uneconomical for a contractor to use non-union labor. I mean, if you're using non-union labor and you're paying them less, you're just not going to be able to get a contract, at least, or you're going to have to pay your workers the same as if they were organized anyway.
So this prevailing wage, which is essentially the labor union wage, I would suspect there's probably a rather complex formula for how it is calculated?
Yeah, it just involves surveying all the workers out there, doing this type of stuff. Traditionally, well, since about the Reagan administration going forward, it had to be a majority of the workers out there doing this type of thing. They would have to go to all the firms and find out what they're paying and then determine using that to sort of basically figure out what the average is and of what the prevailing one is. What the current administration, the Biden administration, is doing is saying we're going to switch the standard to just 30% of the workers out there. Partly this is they're going to claim that this is just this is as accurate as it was previously, but what it means is they're no longer surveying a majority and they're just going to go for 30%. And that means that allows them to essentially cherry pick the data. They can find the 30% of the firms that or companies that they think the best for what they want to do and use it that way. And that essentially gives them more wiggle room to determine what the prevailing wage is rather than if you had to survey an actual majority of them.
If you're only surveying 30% here, Sean, how is that actually prevailing? That's merely a sample.
Right. And that's precisely the case my institute made when we commented on the rulemaking, and I believe others did as well. And the administration just sort of hand-waved that aside. I mean, now, it's not unprecedented. During the Carter administration and previous administrations, they used 30% as the standard. It was more sort of a matter of convenience because everything's held up while you're trying to determine what the prevailing wage is, and they wanted to be able to get it done quicker. But that's not really the case now in the computer age, so there isn't that sort of reason for it. But they're using that as the rationale for saying, well, it was 30% at one point, so we can revert to doing that. And of course, I personally don't think we should be reverting to the way things were done during the Carter administration, but this administration seems to think that it can or should.
I was going to say, if you look at the economic condition of the country under the Carter administration, we had inflation and interest rates that were far higher than even what we're experiencing today. And Sean, the effort has been to try to bring inflation under control. Of course, we've had rising interest rates as part of that effort. So if you're going to start calculating this prevailing wage rate on a very small portion of the overall wages being performed, is this going to continue to drive up the cost of federal projects and ultimately inflation?
I don't see how it can do anything other than that. I'm not sure it's going to do it like radically high, but it's definitely going to create an upward ratchet where these things are just going to start costing more and more.
Sean, given the fact that we have a labor shortage in this country and many companies are struggling to even find employees to do work, is it even necessary to have this sort of artificial wage out there? Or is the marketplace already raising salaries, raising hourly rates to a point where really we don't need a prevailing wage?
That's a very good question. I mean, these are heavy-duty government contracts, you know, construction projects or producing various items for the military or NASA or other things. They're not typically, the government doesn't cheap out on these type of things, and this is the work involved is usually actually pretty high-paying work. I mean, it's certainly not a case where these are people doing stuff at or around the minimum wage. We're talking skilled trades jobs in most cases, and these pay pretty well, in fact. So to a certain extent, this is a little window dressing. Again, it's to ensure, one of the purposes of it is simply to ensure that a non-union firm just doesn't have a competitive advantage in terms of the labor rates. But it's not like those workers are being paid poverty wages. It's just a relative difference of a little bit here and a little bit there. But these are good jobs, I mean, and they're still getting paid well.
This rule about to go into effect, is there any congressional oversight over this at all, or does the administrative state get the final word?
Federal agencies have the power. This is a rulemaking under federal law. The agencies can set these rules, provided that they do them according to a law called the Administrative Procedures Act, which essentially is just the procedure for creating rules, and you have to dot the I's and cross the T's. Congress does have some oversight over this, but it's a hard hill to climb in terms of reversing something like this.
We have been talking with Sean Higgins, and Sean is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a little bit about CEI. Also, where can folks go to read? You've put a policy paper up on this and other topics.
We are a nonprofit think tank located here in Washington, D.C. We specialize in free markets and deregulatory issues. You can read our stuff at CEI.org. It's really easy, just six letters and a period, and it's right there in the middle of the Internet.
Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been keeping an eye on the latest inflation numbers. The news not really all that good. We're going to talk to Scott about that. Scott, good to have you back here.
It's my pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
The latest inflation number came out, this for the month of July, a bit of an uptick. What does this do to the Fed's fight to bring inflation down? And also, let's talk a little bit, Scott, about what it means for the average American family.
Well, what the Fed is going to do is still undetermined. I think a lot of people, all these experts, so-called experts out there, think that since CPI, which is the core measure of inflation, only increased by 0.2% for the month, that maybe the Fed will just kind of hang tight and see what else happens over the next month. But the reality is that you basically have a situation here where inflation is still well above wage increases. And so I think that the American people are feeling it when they go to the grocery store, when they go to the gas pump. One of the things, I've mentioned this before on the show, one of the things that really drives me bonkers is that so often they include what they call core CPI prices, and they exclude energy prices and the price of food. But when you think about your discretionary income and the things that you typically need to buy, you don't really have much of a choice, and that's where you feel the pain. And so really it feels like it's almost a manipulated message coming from the media when they talk about, oh, well, inflation only increased by 3.2%. Obviously, we're not anywhere near where we were just about 14, 15 months ago when we were at 8, 9% month over month and at a 40-year high. But I think when you look at the cumulative effect of the Biden policies that inflicted this record level of inflation, there's no doubt about it in my mind. The American people are worse off today than they were in January 2021 when Joe Biden took over. We've got over 18% cumulative inflation on the American people. That's more than 2 months of your earning power that is gone with the hidden tax of inflation. And I know hardly anybody that's had an 18% increase in their wages in just the last 3 years. So I'm deeply concerned about the state of the economy, and I continue to sort of raise this red flag among many of the people that I talk to in Washington, D.C. Gas prices are beginning to soar. Yes, it's a couple of months later than what I predicted back in May and June, but here we are in August, and in the Northern Virginia area, gas prices are at $3.75. And I'm sure throughout the country there's some places that are over $4 and most places are over $3.60. So that's something that you start to feel. What does that do for cost at the grocery store, right? Everything's transported through that technology that we have in an engine. And trucking costs are more expensive than ever before. So as I continue to sort of monitor the data coming from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we have to understand that the Fed's interest rate spikes, the continued manipulation of our U.S. monetary system, and really the poor policy behavior in Washington, D.C. is breeding this economic harm on the American people. Last week, we got sort of a surprise announcement from Fitch that U.S. credit was downgraded from our AAA status to AA+. And that's just one reaction from the markets based off of the debt limit negotiations that were totally irresponsible. There's so much happening in our economy today. I'm really, really curious to see what the fall looks like and then how that plays going into sort of what should be a spending season with the holidays. But when people don't have the same discretionary income to buy gifts for not just their kids, but maybe their nieces and nephews and their parents. I hate to say it, but maybe Santa's going to have to expand the naughty list and cut some people out of really that consumer behavior. And what does that do for jobs and sort of the early months of 2024 as we're headed into the presidential year? I think it's still a major vulnerability for Joe Biden. And the fact that the Biden administration and really the Biden political team have coined Bidenomics, I expect that to be front and center as we head into 2024.
Well, Joe Biden and his team, Scott, might be the first people we want to put on that naughty list. And by the way, I think I'm going to come to Virginia to buy gas. You're at, what, $3.66 a gallon? My last fill-up was $3.99.9, $4 a gallon. So there you have it, that energy cost beginning to hit the American family. Congress right now, however, they're not in session. A lot of them are at the shore, at the beach, enjoying some time off. Hopefully many of them are talking to constituents back in their districts. What do you see as the top items that are going to be on the agenda when Congress comes back into session next month?
Well, these discussions are ongoing right now, but it is definitely going to be appropriations and how they deal with the funding deadline of September 30th. And who would ever be surprised that once again at the end of the fiscal year, we have to do another funding bill? Well, Congress acts surprised all the time, even though they've set these deadlines and they failed to do their work throughout the summer. I think it's almost political malpractice to take these August recess for 5 weeks when they have only passed one appropriations bill through the House of Representatives. It's definitely setting up what we know as a continuing resolution where federal funding is adhered to at current levels, and they'll include some policy anomalies. I imagine that there will be emergency supplemental related to Ukraine spending. There will be an emergency supplemental probably related to the devastating fire in Hawaii and other natural disasters that are occurring. But that's how they basically get the political momentum to pass all this crap salad. And I hate to use that term, but it is just the continued behavior and spending addiction in Washington. So I think you're seeing House conservatives trying to work with the Republican leadership in the House right now in order to say, hey, let's bring up a bunch of these bills and get them off the table right now so that that's not used against us for leverage when the Democrats shut down the government. And of course, the media and the Democrats will blame the Republicans since we hold power. But the reality is that there's been so much time to deal with our debt and deficit issues. They continue to kick the can down the road. And I think that this September season is going to be about 11 days in session, and there's just no way that they can get all their appropriations work done.
We will keep a close eye on that. We'll keep a close eye on the economy. We will do all of that with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 members from all 50 states in America. You can actually sign up for free at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Loman.
Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has a new podcast series on why government is the reason we can't have nice things. He previews the series with a look at the recent baby formula shortage.
Politics crossed with trade equals protectionism. That's the formula for why we can't have nice things. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Why We Can't Have Nice Things is the title of my new podcast series. It's a 6-part limited run series. The first 2 episodes are live now at Reason.com on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere else you might find your podcasts. And this week on the show, I thought I'd just give you a little bit of a sneak preview or a little bit of a taste of what the first episode of that series is like. This week on the show, I'm giving you a little taste of the first episode of that series where we looked at the great baby formula shortage of 2022 when American grocery store shelves turned into scenes from the old Soviet Union, just empty shelves as far as you could see. We talked to some moms who dealt with the shortage, and we also talked to some trade policy experts who explained why this mess happened in the first place and how we might be able to avoid having something like this happen again in the future. Take a listen.
I remember there was this time in the store where it was later on in the shortage, and I had what I wanted in my hand, and it was the last one on the shelf, and there was a dad in the aisle, and I saw him like looking at the empty shelf of what I had just taken.
When American parents faced a sudden shortage of baby formula last year, the crisis turned routine trips to the grocery store into sometimes complicated moral dilemmas.
I had the last package in my hand. He looked at that spot on the shelf and was like, I couldn't tell if he just was looking at the shelves in general or if that was the product that he needed. I just asked him, like, Is this what you need?
That's a situation most of us have thankfully not had to encounter. American grocery stores are wondrous places, celebrations of prosperity and plenty, everything at your fingertips, until suddenly empty store shelves force new parents to scramble to find enough formula to keep their infants fed. One of those new parents was my friend Kenzie.
My name is Kenzie Giacomo. I have one child. One and done, so if Mom, if you're listening, quit asking.
Kenzie's daughter, Cora, was born just before the baby formula shortage hit in the spring of 2022.
She was born 6 weeks early, so actually in the beginning of her formula life, she was using a special high-calorie formula.
And that's why Kenzie found herself on that day last summer staring down a dad in the formula aisle of her neighborhood store. Two needy parents with two hungry kids and only one package of formula to go around.
I just asked him, like, is this what you need? Luckily, he's like, no, that's not what I need specifically. But it was a kind of a tender moment of solidarity.
I'm Eric Boehm, and you're listening to a Reason Magazine podcast series about how bad government policies screw over everyone in order to benefit the special interests that often have a hand in writing those rules. Protectionism makes us all poorer, often in ways that we don't really notice or think about. But occasionally, those policies spiral out of control in ways that simply can't be ignored.
When you walk into the store and there you don't see that packaging, there's nothing there to get, you start to panic. Like, what am I going to feed my baby? You think to what you have in your kitchen. How many more bottles is that going to get you? How many more days is that going to get you? And you start just thinking, if I can't get this formula, how is my baby going to eat?
The baby formula supply shock started with contamination issues at Abbott Nutrition's plant in Sturgis, Michigan. That plant was shut down by the FDA in February of 2022. It wouldn't reopen until June, and it would be late summer before the plant was operating at full capacity again. Additionally, Abbott had to recall some of its products, including the popular Similac brand.
Within a matter of 3 months, out-of-stock rates moved from 28% to 75%, and that's because retailers were essentially in a bind.
That's Gabriella Beaumont-Smith, a trade policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Beaumont-Smith has been closely following the baby formula crisis since it began. She says that the, sorry, formula for the crisis actually has two parts. First, there's the tightly regulated domestic market.
So the company Abbott Nutrition has over 55% of U.S. market share. The remainder is basically split between two other companies. This plant on its own, though, produces almost 40% of U.S. formula. And the other two players that exist were just, they don't have the production capacity to service the U.S. market.
If retailers, and by extension, parents and customers, couldn't refill their supplies with American-made baby formula, perhaps they could look to suppliers in other countries. Ah, but that's where the second problem appears.
But there are these distribution channels that are basically not established because it's too costly, and these tariffs are absurdly high. Between 2012 and 2021, most imports of infant formula were subject to tariffs over 25%. And we're talking about baby formula. This is a necessity, and we shouldn't be taxing it that high or at all.
If you're a domestic formula maker, that's a pretty sweet deal. Your competitors from overseas face a tax and regulatory scheme that effectively bans them from getting on American store shelves. As a result, roughly 98% of baby formula consumed in America before the crisis was produced by American companies. And most Americans probably had no idea about this, at least not until last summer when the FDA lifted some of those rules and Congress temporarily suspended the tariffs.
I saw on the news that, like, oh, other countries, they're finally allowing other countries to bring stuff in. And I was like, wait a minute, we weren't allowing? Like, I had no idea that that was even a thing that we prevented, that was even an option that could have happened sooner. It just was like, it opened my eyes to some of the limitations we put on ourselves and things we prevent from happening just in our market. It made me realize, like, oh, we're kind of doing this to ourselves.
You've been listening to the first episode of Why We Can't Have Nice Things. That's my new podcast series at Reason.com. You can find it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. That's just the beginning of the episode. There's a lot more about the baby formula shortage. Episode 2 is now live as well. Thanks for listening. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It was a rare opportunity to interview Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College recalls the experience on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The film world is abuzz right now over a major biopic on the legendary physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb. The film has opened old debates about Oppenheimer's communist sympathies, as well as the enduring question of the morality of making, let alone using, atomic weapons. But for me, it brought back memories of the most unique experience that I had with Edward Teller, an Oppenheimer nemesis and likewise a father of the bomb. That is, the hydrogen bomb, the H-bomb, the hell bomb, the super bomb. Coincidentally, it was this summer 20 years ago that I had a fascinating encounter with Edward Teller. I spent an afternoon with him on his deathbed, it turned out, that I've certainly never forgotten. It was July 15th, 2003. Incidentally, 8 days before President George W. Bush would award the legendary physicist the Presidential Medal of Freedom in a ceremony that the 95-year-old Teller was too sick to attend. I came to interview Teller for research I was doing on Ronald Reagan and the Cold War. Teller had first met Reagan back in 1967 and was a major influence on SDI, his Strategic Defense Initiative. So I excitedly drove to Teller's house on Girona Road in Palo Alto, California. I was shocked at the total lack of any security around this man who had invented the most powerful weapon in history. I was even more shocked, however, at his condition. I had come upon a dying man. The 95-year-old was almost completely horizontal in a light blue recliner with the upper part of his body slightly propped up. A bunch of books sat nearby. The one closest to Teller, which he was reading, was the book Men Who Play God, The Story of the Hydrogen Bomb by British journalist Norman Ross. Men Who Play God, fittingly, focused on men like Edward Teller. Above all, it was about Teller because Teller was, as I said, the father of the hydrogen bomb. And yet, Teller was hardly one to assume that he was ever playing God because, in fact, Teller had many lingering questions about the mere existence of God, as I was about to find out. Amid a long discussion with Teller, which ranged from Ronald Reagan to Reykjavik, one subject kept returning, religion. Dr. Teller told me emphatically in his thick Hungarian accent, "I strongly believe that I should not talk about things I don't understand." And yet, it was the subject that kept coming back up. It was the elephant in the living room. So many topics of discussion that day prompted philosophical celestial reflections from the physicist. At one point, we somehow ended up talking about the complexity of a strand of DNA. He was a scientist, after all. And that led to a dialogue with Teller about a possible designer, that is a capital D designer, a creator. Once again, Teller retreated. "You asked me about God, and I will say, I don't know." When I later talked to Teller's assistant, I told her about our religious probes and, alas, how they seemed to consistently hit a dead end. "Well," she sighed, "he's keeping it to himself," unquote. Yes, literally until the very end. That end came just a few weeks later when Edward Teller died on September 9th, 2003 at the age of 95. And to my knowledge, I was the last person to interview. There is much I've reflected upon since that interview with Teller 20 years ago. But the one thing that keeps coming back to me is that human beings really are hardwired for God. We have a spiritual side that is undeniable, inescapable. Teller seemed to sense it, certainly in those final days. Ultimately, this man who once unlocked the power of the universe in the atom, the man of whom it was alleged played God with a hydrogen bomb, laid alone in his bed by himself, waiting to one day meet his maker. It is the ultimate fate of each of us. And at some point, we will all know and understand. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kenyor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXCR-FM in Florence, Oregon, KFMR-FM in Jackson, Wyoming, along with KELO-AM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.